Greetings and welcome to the Journal of Southern Religion podcast. My name is Art Remillard. I'm the book review editor for the JSR and I teach at St. Francis University in Loretto, Pennsylvania. In an 1838 speech, Abraham Lincoln made reference to an outbreak of violence that had happened in Mississippi 3 years prior. He explained that rumors of a slave insurrection that summer resulted in the hanging of everyone from enslaved people to gamblers and white citizens. Lincoln painted a gruesome picture saying, quote, "Dead men were seen literally dangling from the boughs of trees upon every roadside, and in numbers almost sufficient to rival the native Spanish moss of the country as a drapery of the forest." As Lincoln's comments might tell us, Mississippi's summer of 1835 has become a reference point for violence, lawlessness, and chaos in antebellum America. My guest today, Joshua Rothman, brings background and context to this story in his new book, Flush Times and Fever Dreams, A Story of Capitalism and Slavery in the Age of Jackson, published by the University of Georgia Press in 2012. Professor Rothman is an associate professor of history at the University of Alabama and director of the Summersfield Center for the Study of the South. Josh, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm happy to do it.
I obviously want to get to the riot, but first connect the dots for me. Your 2003 book, Notorious in the Neighborhood, is a sweeping history of interracial sex before the Civil War in Virginia. So how did you get from here to a book about Mississippi between the years 1833 and 1835?
Well, you know, the connection for me in the broadest sense is my interest in issues of race and slavery, which I think is the one obvious connection from one book to the next. But really, I came across this story almost by happenstance. I had finished the first book and I was fishing around for a second project to work on. I really didn't have anything necessarily in particular in mind other than broad scholarly interests, and I had assigned a book to some graduate students one of my first years here at Alabama in the early 2000s. It was actually Daniel Dupree's book on the evolution of northern Alabama and Madison County, Alabama, and the city of Huntsville. And I noticed in a footnote, really, he was talking about this massive insurrection scare that broke out that had this sort of ripple effect on the part of Alabama he was talking about. But I had never heard of this event before, and I just kind of followed the dots from there. I was curious about it. It had the violence. It had slavery. It had some things about gambling and gamblers. It had sort of bandits and outlaws and slave stealers. And it just struck me as a potentially really interesting story, and more than anything else, just surprising. I had never heard of it before. And one thing led to another, and you know, 8 years later, I found myself finishing a book about it.
Most histories of capitalism of this era seem to focus on the Northeast, whereas you go to the South. So what is the difference, and what does this bring to the story?
Well, I think that most of the material that we've seen in recent historiography, and by recent I really mean the last 20 or 30 years, the material that's come out about what used to be called the market revolution, and now that term is sort of going out of vogue, but just the evolution of a national market capitalist economy in antebellum America, so much of that material is about places like New York and the evolution of the change from kind of rural values to urban values and sort of agricultural values to bourgeois values and the evolution of the middle class and things like that. And a lot of that regionally has been about the Northeast and the Midwest. And I think for very good reasons. I think industrial capitalism evolved obviously much more quickly and much more deeply in those parts of the country than it did in the South. But I think that we too easily shunted the South away from that part of the story, from integrating the South into our story of how the American economy unfolded in the 19th century. I think, you know, that's happened, I think, in part because the part of the country that I'm writing about in this book was, at the time, a frontier. Frontiers are always seen as kind of peripheral and a little bit atypical. I think the biggest reason is because of slavery. Slavery, for a lot of scholars, fits very awkwardly into stories about the evolution of capitalism for a variety of different reasons. The more I got into this story, the more I was really struck by the relationship between the cotton economy unfolding in the Southwest and the development of the industrial economy of the Northeast. I was struck by a lot of values of the people who were living in the Southwest, particularly the people in towns and cities in some ways are aspiring to a similar kind of bourgeois lifestyle. And the people who are living out in rural and agricultural areas are really ruthlessly interested in issues of profit and loss. I mean, the cotton economy is rooted in profit. That's essentially what it's about. I wouldn't go so far as to make the argument that there's no difference between Northeast and Southwest, but I do think that we need to make a better effort at integrating the South and slavery and the cotton economy into the story that we've come to tell ourselves about how capitalism unfolded.
You write that, quote, "the Southwest in the flush times was defined as much by suspicion, fraud, and extraordinary levels of violence as by opportunity, confidence, and enterprise." And these just seem like two different things going on here. Can you tell us what you meant when you were talking about that?
Sure. I think actually they are not so much two different things as they are two sides of the same coin, really. Certainly in the popular imagination, the story that we tell ourselves about capitalism is that it's about free agents and individuals finding opportunity and sort of niches for themselves in markets, and they're able to go out there and work hard and rise up the ladder. It's very much a sort of free labor ideology that scholars are obviously much more critical of than I think the general population, but that is nonetheless the story is rooted in opportunity and confidence and enterprise and entrepreneurialism. And there's certainly a fair amount of that in the Southwest. There is a lot of opportunity. There is a lot of enterprise. There's a lot of people going and trying to kind of make it for themselves as individuals. But it's also a place where the economy unfolds in such a way that you have thousands of people, none of whom are familiar to each other. They're all migrating to this landscape where they're all going to go and try to find a place in the cotton economy. And there's a lot of opportunity for cheating. There's a lot of opportunity for fraud. There's a lot of opportunity for con men to work all sorts of angles. And there's a lot of violence. Some of it is the inherent violence that comes with slavery. Some of it is going to a place where institutions of law and order, as they're conventionally understood, are sort of unformed. And I think that when you turn people loose on a frontier like this, and they're all trying to make a go of it, it doesn't always work smoothly. It's not sort of people sitting in a clerk's office working hard and rising up the ladder, and someday they become a manager, and someday they own the bank. Sometimes it's people whose interests collide with one another. Sometimes it's people who find out that they're being cheated. Sometimes it's people who find that they would rather settle their differences with guns and knives than with lawsuits.
I want to turn now to the heart of your book, Virgil Stewart and John Merrill, their stories. Tell us what you mean when you talk about the, quote, inventing of both of these men.
The first two chapters of the book, called Inventing Virgil Stewart, and the other one is called Inventing John Merrill, they're really two different kinds of invention. Stewart, in some ways, is the character in the book who really sets all of these events that are at the heart of the book in motion. He is really nobody of great significance. He is just some guy who grows up in a sort of lower class household in Georgia, and his father dies when he's very, very young. He really doesn't have a whole lot going for him in Georgia, but he is taken in by a lot of the rhetoric of the Age of Jackson, which is about white men being able to go and sort of make something of themselves. And the place where you would do that in this time, in the 1820s and 1830s, were places like Tennessee, Alabama, and Mississippi. This is where all the action in the economy is happening. This is where, you know, the development of cotton and of slavery supposedly enables this great white male democracy. So he sort of goes out to West Tennessee and eventually into northern Mississippi, and he decides he is going to invent himself. He is going to make himself a person of substance. And so the first chapter is the ways he attempts to do that, and the ways that project really goes very south very quickly and in a pretty pathetic way. But what he does is he's one of these guys who's always trying to salvage the situation, no matter how bad things are. And usually they're bad because he's messed it up for himself. But no matter how bad things are, he refuses to blame himself for his own faults. It's always somebody else's fault, and he's always trying to salvage it. He is, in a way, if you can manage this paradox, he is in a way both profoundly cynical but also profoundly optimistic. He never really gives up. And where the John Merle part of the story comes in is one of the things that, Virgil Stewart does is he's always looking to try to kind of insinuate himself with men who already had made a name for themselves or who already had money and power. And he's always hoping that one of those people will kind of give him the leg up in the world that he's looking for. And along the course of his travels, one of the people he decides to help is a man in West Tennessee who is a kind of medium-sized slaveholder, sort of a small planter, who asks Stewart to help him track down two slaves that have gone missing. And he suspects John Merle, who is a sort of local farmer and kind of a petty crook. He suspects John Merle of having stolen them, basically sort of run off with these two slaves with the intent of selling them somewhere else. So Merle agrees to help this guy out. He goes, he tracks down Merle, he follows him for a while. He never really finds the slaves that are missing, but what he does is he invents this story where John Merle is not just a petty crook and a slave stealer, but he is a master criminal. He is the leader of a band of 1,000 outlaws that are going to spark a slave insurrection all over the South. And so that's where the kind of invention of Merle comes in. Stewart's invention is really a story about an attempt at self-invention in an age when that was supposed to be something anyone could do. Merle's part of the story is something that Stewart really creates as a way of inflating himself, because the bigger the criminal that someone like Stewart brings down, the bigger the man that Stewart would be.
And this guy, Merle, was a pretty noted criminal. I mean, can you tell us about, you know, you have Mark Twain talking about how Merle used to pose as an itinerant preacher, and then kind of his people would go out and pilfer from the crowd. Could you tell us about that? Because this is really kind of an interesting entry point for understanding morality in this area.
Yeah, sure. And that story that Twain tells in Life on the Mississippi is something that he got from Stewart's pamphlet. What Stewart does when he comes back from this trip is he writes up the story of his travels in this it's about 75 or 80 page pamphlet in which he explains his trip, all the things that Merle supposedly told him and things like that. And one of the, among the many stories that Stewart tells is one where Merle said he's a criminal who runs kind of low level scams, basically. And one that he ran that was really popular is he would dress up in the, you know, the sort of long black frock coat of a Methodist circuit rider. And he would sort of go out from place to place and pretend to be a Methodist minister. And he would go and give sermons, basically. He would sort of preach to a crowd. And sometimes he would preach to a crowd and say that he was a slaveholder but wanted to divest himself of slavery. And this was one way he would unload stolen slaves. He would sort of, in the guise of a minister, he would sell them. But sometimes he would just have his sort of associates work the crowd, basically. So while the crowd was paying attention to Merle, his associates would be kind of running off with their horses or picking people's pockets or things like that. You know, this was a great disguise because on the one hand, Methodist ministers were sort of traveling all over the place, and you just sort of took people's word that they were who they said they were, particularly if it was a minister, right? Because you knew that not everybody was who they appeared to be, but a minister. No one ever suspected a minister, and that's why it was just a sort of brilliant disguise for Merle to use. Now, what starts happening after a while is that Methodist ministers do start to become very suspect characters. And there is some historiography on this. Christine Hyerman's book comes to mind where she talks about Methodist ministers being suspect for ideological reasons because for a long time they are anti-slavery. But I think a sort of larger suspicion starts to attach to Methodist circuit riders as a consequence of people like Merle abusing that anonymity and that itinerancy to enact all sorts of criminal scams.
Very interesting. So tell me then, how do we get from the pamphlet to Vicksburg to the gambling riot of 1835? And on to that, was it as bad as Lincoln said?
Ah, now that those are two sort of very long questions. Okay, so Stewart writes this pamphlet. Okay, so the first thing that happens is Stewart comes back from his travels with Merle, and Merle goes on trial in West Tennessee, and he is actually convicted. He's convicted of slave stealing, and he's sentenced to 10 years in prison. Now, none of the newspapers in West Tennessee thought Stewart was telling the truth. He gets up on the witness stand, he tells this crazy elaborate story, and all the newspapers who knew John Merle and they knew you know, the story of this guy's travels, they said, this is a hell of a story, but there's no way it's true. And even though Merle is convicted, Stewart really resents that sort of questioning of his integrity. You know, he goes out there, he takes a risk, he travels with dangerous men to try to help out men who are already wealthy. And what does he get for it? All he gets for it is people making fun of him, people who don't believe him, and it enrages him. And so what he does is he writes up this pamphlet in which he becomes the hero of his own story. And the pamphlet is actually much more elaborate than anything he said at the trial. At the trial, he doesn't talk about the sort of criminal confederacy. He doesn't talk about the plots for a slave insurrection. He makes that up after all of this suspicion of his story falls out. And so he publishes this thing in the spring of 1835. And even after that comes out, again, the newspapers in the places where John Merle was a known person, they read the pamphlet and they're like, wow, we thought the testimony was crazy. Wait until you get a load of this pamphlet. This is nuts. There is no way this is true. But outside of West Tennessee, Stewart kind of travels around the lower Mississippi Valley trying to sell this pamphlet. He's mostly in it to kind of get his name back. But, you know, he needs to make a little money, too. So he goes around selling this thing. And in this one county in Mississippi, it catches on. It converges with rumors of a slave insurrection that were already pre-existing there. Stewart had been in this county before, so people kind of knew who he was. And one thing leads to another, and essentially what happens is just hysteria unfolds. The people in this county in Mississippi become convinced Merle's plan is still ongoing, that there's going to be a massive slave insurrection scare on the 4th of July, and the whole thing just spins out of control. There are vigilance committees that start to get formed. Posses start riding around the countryside. Slaves are tortured to extract information from them. They, in turn, give up the names of some white men who are kind of suspect characters for a variety of reasons. And when all is said and done, there's anywhere from 1 to 2 dozen people who are executed without benefit of anything that resembles a real trial. So that is going on in the interior of Mississippi in late June, early July, 1835. And at the same time, in Vicksburg, which is about 50 miles from where the insurrection scare really breaks out, there is a confrontation at a 4th of July barbecue between sort of the people who consider themselves kind of the respectable citizens of the town of Vicksburg and some basically sort of ruffians who are known to be professional gamblers. And that confrontation in turn escalates and ends up with 5 suspected professional gamblers being dragged out of a house, yanked over to a public gallows, and they are hanged unceremoniously. And both of these events sort of get bigger and bigger and bigger. The slave insurrection scare goes beyond this county and spreads throughout most of Mississippi, into Louisiana, over into Alabama and Tennessee. I found bits and pieces of it scattered as far away as northern Florida and into Virginia. The gambling riot, meanwhile, spreads into a desire to purge professional gamblers. Pretty much every major town I've found on the Mississippi and Ohio rivers, from New Orleans in the south all the way up to places like Wheeling in the northeast. And the pamphlet doesn't really have anything to do with the gambling riot exactly. In a lot of ways, these events are things that just happen by coincidence. They're very close by one another. They're both extremely violent. They happen at about the same time. But I do think that prospectively, at least looking forward, they're just a coincidence. But what I argue in the book is that what's at the root of both of them are larger anxieties about the development of the economy in the Southwest. People in the slaveholding parts of Mississippi are terrified of the idea that slave stealers could be working among them systematically to kind of undermine the slave regime that they're trying to get off the ground. And in part, that's a racial anxiety, but in part, it's a financial anxiety. Most of these men don't actually own the slaves that they're using. They have borrowed money to buy them. And what they're all trying to do is get out of debt. If they can't sustain this slave regime, if there's a massive insurrection that overturns everything, not only will people die, but they will all be ruined. In Vicksburg, meanwhile, I think the anxiety is about an economy that's rooted a lot in debt and credit and speculation. And gamblers sort of embody kind of boiling that economy down to its essence. I mean, that's what gamblers are. They are speculators. They are nothing but figuring out the odds, wagering on the future, seeing what happens. And people in a place like Vicksburg, where the economy is so overheated, so much speculation, so much debt, people who are not really engaging in the kinds of industrious, frugal, productive activities that they like to think that they were, gamblers are the kinds of people who really trigger that anxiety a lot. And when they get to a point where they are interfering, as they were at this 4th of July event, with people who considered themselves respectable, they push a very, very sensitive button. And what ends up happening is just a tremendous explosion of violence.
This is interesting, that the violence, the conflicting morals going on, the intersection of money and of race. And as I'm reading through this, I'm seeing kind of these religious figures popping up along the way. There's ministers grumbling about low attendance. There are theories that it's black preachers that are the culprits behind this plot.
Yes.
There's a lot of other things, and I'm wondering, for our listeners' sake, I mean, as a scholar of Southern religion myself, I saw a lot going on here, but what do you think, what do you want to tell scholars of Southern religion? What should they take away from this?
That is actually a really interesting question, as someone who's not a scholar of Southern religion myself. And I think you're right that religion is something that hovers around the edges in a number of ways. But if there's one thing that I came back to over and over and over again in this story, it was the observations by so many people that religion, or church-going really specifically, is the issue. Church-going is practically non-existent in these places. People said about Vicksburg all the time, business goes on 7 days a week. These people, they never go to church. I mean, there is a church or two in Vicksburg, but they don't have any regular ministers. They have one building. I think it's the Presbyterian Church. It's falling apart. There's another church that doesn't even have a building yet. What I really get the sense of in this place is that the question for me, at least for scholars of religion, and maybe this is a better way to put it, what I would have to teach is less important maybe than what they would have to teach me, is how do we get from a place where it's a frontier society, where people are there really without too much shame because they want money. They want quick, easy money. And they do it by using land that's stolen from Indians. They use it by exploiting African-American labor. They use it by borrowing against the future and sort of creating these kinds of crazy pyramids of debt. How do they get from there to a place where religion is something that they really value? What does it say about the morality of that religion once it gets imported, given that this is sort of the foundation that it rests upon? And I don't really know how that happens. In some ways, that happens after my story. In some ways, actually, I suspect it may be a product of things like the Panic of 1837, which is where my story ends. The Panic of 1837 comes, and it ruins a lot out of these men. It's a disaster economically. And I found myself wondering, although I don't really engage it in the book, as to whether there is a kind of turn toward religion and a turn toward a sense that this economy, rooted in so much just naked greed and violence and speculation, maybe needs something to balance it a little bit more morally.
Well, let me ask you one more question here. Stuart and Merrill kind of have legacies in popular culture. Can you tell us about this, and why do you think these people have been so popular in popular culture, even though there are some historians such as myself who are very, well, frankly, just not that familiar until I read your book.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question. This is something that I found sort of amazing, actually, which is that, you know, the Stuart and Merle were people who, if you were in the United States in any time between 1835 and I would say well into the 1850s, you knew who these people were. Everybody knew this story. I think what happens to the story in some ways is that bigger bandits come along. First, you have people like John Brown. Then you have the Civil War, which sort of obliterates, in some ways, popular memory going back in the decades before the Civil War. Then you have people like the James Gang and that sort of that set of bandits of the Old West, and people like John Merle, who I think in a lot of ways are the precursor to people like that. He's a precursor to Jesse James in some ways. He's a precursor to John Brown in other ways. But Merle himself sort of disappears from people's popular memory. He really becomes a subject that for folklorists. You know, there are other sort of bandits of this era. There's there's Lafitte the Pirate, Wiley and Earl Harp, and the Harp brothers, and this gang, and these are things that have become folklore more than kind of popular memory. But what I found when I was trying to trace basically, okay, well, what does happen to these guys in popular culture? What I was amazed by is no matter how many short stories and novels and television shows and movies, no matter how many of those I found that try to use this story in some way or another, every time I thought I'd found the last one, I find another one and another one and another one. I think I've come across dozens of short stories. I've come across at least a dozen and a half novels. There's at least two different television shows and a movie that were made about these people, and they don't go away. There was a book that came out, I think it's probably 3 or 4 years ago at this point, called Canaan's Tongue by an author named John Ray. And he's a sort of, you know, I think a kind of mid-level novelist, not hugely well-known, but not obscure either. And he wrote a novel sort of putting the Merle and Stuart story in the context of the Civil War. I found a short story by Eudora Welty. I found references to the story in Faulkner and Borges and all kinds of places you'd never expect to see it. And I think there's two reasons why they've kind of lived on at this sort of low level of popular culture. I think one reason is that the story is very malleable. The story could be used for mysteries and westerns and stories about slavery and stories about con men and bandits, and you could use it in all sorts of different ways. Most of the things that I've come across don't just do a straight retelling of the Stuart and Merle story. They usually kind of tweak the story a little bit to tell a little bit of a different story. So that's one reason I think they come back a lot. But another reason I think has to do with the relationship to slavery. I found that the stories that weren't the kind of pulp stories, you know, the ones that tried to take this a little bit more seriously and invest some of the themes with a bit of weight to them, those were the ones that really tried to use the story to reflect on kind of the real sort of darkness of slavery, that slaves were really just tools to be used by white men, the level of exploitation, the level of corruption in Southern society. And I think the story can fit really, really well in those themes too. And in some ways, those are the themes that I'm trying to get at in the book. And I think that's why people who consider themselves serious, you know, people who create serious literature and serious art are drawn to the story over and over again. I suspect that, like me, there are people who just stumbled on the story somewhere or another and looked at it a little more and said to themselves, this is amazing. Why does nobody know about this?
Indeed. And I have to say, I think this would make a great movie. So with that, we're going to conclude this podcast. Again, the book is Flush Times and Fever Dreams, a story of capitalism and slavery in the age of Jackson. Thank you to Josh Rothman for joining us. You can learn more about him and the Summersill Center for the Study of the South at scss.ua.edu. While you're at it, click on over to the Journal of Southern Religion at jsr.fsu.edu. There you can listen to this and other podcasts, subscribe to our iTunes feed, and join us on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.